ever since Eve bit into an apple in the Garden of Eden, God has been rough on women. Or, more precisely, the men who claim to speak on behalf of God have routinely disparaged women or discriminated against them. The New York Times, March 31st, 2018.
Mic check, 1, 2, 1, 2. I'll just bring in an introduction right here. The Ordinary Times. Check, 1, 2. Stories for people who only attend church on Christmas and Easter, where we explore the parallel narratives between the good news and the good newspaper. It is corny.
Extra, extra!
That March 31st, 2018 opinion piece from the New York Times that caught my eye was called God and Her Female Clergy. It told of the historic resistance to women in ministry amongst Christian and Jewish congregations across America. It shared how this was usually explained by citing Old Testament law and New Testament epistle as a justification. Then it cited Reverend Serene Jones, the first woman president of New York City's Union Theological Seminary, where almost 60% of the students are now female. And it told of Rabbi Emily Barton, who presides over a conservative synagogue in Des Moines, Iowa, who advised, "If I was giving advice to women who wanted to be clergy, I'd say, be okay with being uncomfortable, because there are always going to be things in your religion that make you uncomfortable. Sometimes you just have to live with your discomfort." Which brings us to our scripture reading for today of John chapter 12, verses 1 through 8, where a Jewish woman named Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus, does not let being uncomfortable or criticized get in the way of serving the Lord. Today we'll interview Sue Park Herr and discuss her ministry in Christian peacemaking, leadership in racial reconciliation, and perspective on listening to women as they answer Christ's call.
Gospel.
The Gospel according to John, chapter 12, verses 1 through 8. Then Jesus, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, which had been dead, whom he raised from the dead. There they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of them that sat at the table with him.
If you're ready, and I'm going to throw a hypothetical situation your way.
Yeah.
So let's say you are a frequent visitor to Pasadena Mennonite Church, and you have a family. At a certain point in service, every Sunday, you take your kids down to like the daycare to do more of a children's study and worship, and become friends with the lady who works down there often, pretty nice and friendly, and then you go back out. So one Sunday, the special Sunday, and you see that nice lady, she's the speaker delivering the sermon. And not only is she the speaker, but it's an ordination for one of the pastoral staff. And like, oh, that nice lady, wow, she's really informed. She's really on point. And talk to someone inside you, and they inform you that this nice lady takes care of your kid, is a humongous big wig. And she's not only the speaker this Sunday, but she's also big high up in the Mennonite denominational leadership. So she's overseeing racial and ethnic engagement. She used to be over transformative peacemaking. You're like, wow, I'm really impressed. And then you find out that she's one of the co-founders of Reconciliation, you know, the nonprofit peace center in Los Angeles connected to equipping Korean and Asian American churches and communities to serve in different ways. So I ran a hypothetical past you, if there was such a person who existed like that, but it sounds a lot like you.
Oh my goodness, you're so funny.
Tell me a little bit about your backstory. What brought you to this position, or several positions, this life experience, and balancing that, you're a fairly humble person for being fairly influential, and it seems to gel with your, I think people would say things like servant leadership, but I have mixed feelings on that phrase. I think it connects more with not just your servant leadership, your view on Christianity and how to be a Christian. And so tell me a little bit about your backstory and how it brings you where you are.
Oh, goodness, Jason. Thanks for that hypothetical introduction.
Purely hypothetical.
Yeah, get your lemonade out or get and take off your shoes and let me tell you a story.
Sure.
I mean, I have a long story and it's hard to know where to begin. I mean, my husband and I have been in ministry together for a long time. We've been married for 25 years and we met in the church before that. So, and the way that we met in Korea. A place that I was born, but a place that I felt disconnected from growing up in America, feeling very assimilated. So there's reconciliation right there between my, I had needed to reconcile myself of who I am and that whole exploration of identity, right? And then figuring things out. You know, in 92, it's very interesting that we're having this conversation because we're at the cusp of the 30th commemoration of the LA uprising, Saigu. Koreans call it Saigu. That means 429 because it was April 29th. An event that we can't even name right, right? We call it LA riot, LA uprising, Saigu, so many other names because it was unnameable. And we still have a hard time naming it. And so that was also very formative in understanding where am I, you know, and what is my work? And how does everything that I understand of my sociology background, with my Asian American study background, what does that have to do with what was unfolding? Sure. And so that term, which is also very controversial right now, this term of reconciliation is something that I'm reconciling with all through how I understand my faith, I understand my call, and who I am to be. Growing up as a child of an immigrant, you start right there.
You mentioned 1992, the events in the uprising, in the riots, several names, you know, that goes by 429. So I'm African American and you're Korean American. Now, I was not born in Los Angeles. I came here at like age 27. I'm from New Orleans. I'm from Louisiana. As many folks in recent years have been commemorating those events, a lot of the background that's been discussed in documentaries and podcasts and such, there wasn't just simmering tension between the police community and the African-American community, but in several events, there was a big simmering tension between the Korean-American community and the African-American community, especially with business owners in what was South Central, now South Los Angeles, and of course in Koreatown as well. So you talked about that being a formative event in your view of reconciliation, and your view of reconciliation has shaped or has been shaped by your view of what Christ did and is doing.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, growing up in the church, hearing these words, we don't even hear it much. You know, the gospel is the gospel of between you and God, right? That you're saved.
Yeah.
And that is all. That's all. That's like the heart of what it means to be saved. And I think that event really helped me to re-examine what I believed in, what I believed about the work of the church, what it meant for us to live in community with people of different backgrounds, of different ethnicity and race as we saw things unfolding. I think I didn't have the words, I didn't have the framework when I was, you know, 30 years ago to really mm-hmm. assess what was really happening. We did see, you know, my parents had a store, and I know about those encounters and the narratives between Black and Asians. But what I saw unfold in LA was that it wasn't just Black and white. There were Latinx in the media. And what happened to the police officers and the narrative that was supposed to be so central that unleashed everything, right? That broke the and the watershed moment of this, like, why did this happen? From focusing on police brutality and the exposure of that video, focusing on that and addressing that, instead of doing that, what the media narrated was this tension between Black and Koreans, right? Mm-hmm. And so, so again, we're diverting the story and we're re-narrating from a specific lens of the media to show and to hide what's shown and what's hidden in that was really jarring to me, because we're on the ground. I'm here on the ground. I see my church and on near Pico and Norton, like, coming closer and closer, and you know, the people who are, you know, angry, and mobs are coming, and it wasn't a Black and Korean thing, mm-hmm. and so what was being told and what I saw was very different. And I said, what is going on? And I really wanted to unravel that. Who's telling the story? What's being untold? I think those are the questions that started to surface. And what does this all have to do with the gospel, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't know how to integrate a lot of that. And I think my life work has been to really examine all of those intersections. In meeting my husband, I think that was one of the most crucial part, was that he had that Anabaptist perspective, even though mm-hmm. we weren't going to a Mennonite church, because we didn't have one. We didn't have a Korean Mennonite church or a peace church. And so we started exploring what that meant. And you know, when we kind of imagined and we talked about this vision of what a church should be, while we were going to a mega church in Korea, mm-hmm. Where we served as mission pastors for a long time. And, you know, people said, well, that sounds really great, but that just seems impossible. Mm-hmm. And so you show us if that can be done, because that can't be done. And someone like you and someone like me, probably it's like, we love that challenge, right? Like, oh, it can't be done. Well, actually, there are people who've been doing this for hundreds of years. And once we discover that, mm-hmm. you realize you're not crazy. There are actually people with tradition and faith and history of people who've been doing it, not maybe so well, but they've been at it. And so that's what compelled us to join the Mennonite Church. Mm-hmm. And also to explore, what does this gospel and finding the theology that compelled us to do all the integrative work, right? Not only is mm-hmm. the gospel of salvation between me and God, but that the core of our gospel is the gospel of peace and reconciliation. What does that look like in someone like me, right? Someone mm-hmm. who is a child of an immigrant, who was born in Korea but raised here. What does that look like? How is that fleshed out? Because when we talk about this theology, people said, that sounds good, but it doesn't work for someone like us. And so we wanted to mm-hmm. explore that. And that's why we started a peace center called Reconciliation, to talk mm-hmm. about what does that look like? How is that fleshed out? So what does it mean for me to have, what does it mean to reconcile with God? What does it mean to reconcile? What does the gospel of peace and reconciliation look like in our families? Because it's not just this cosmic thing. Yes, it is this cosmic thing, but how is that fleshed out, and how does that impact us now, right? And I felt always mm-hmm. this gap between my faith and this cosmic God. And So then we started to flesh it out. Like, what does that look like in my family? What does that look like in our church when so many immigrants split all the time? The very place where we're supposed to learn about that God is good and loving and God loves community was the very place where I saw most conflict. I don't know a Korean church that hasn't split. And what does that look like when what does the gospel of peace and reconciliation look like in our neighbors, in our neighborhood, right? Can a non-English speaking grandma like do the ministry of peace and reconciliation? And what does that look like? And can we, those are the hidden stories, right? Like, heck yeah! They know how to do this like so well with no words and with a smile and with food and with kind gestures, right? Like, can we notice that and can we recognize that that's also the heart of what the gospel is? And what does that look like nationally, right? How do we engage in the work of peace and reconciliation nationally? Are there areas, right, where we need to speak into that we haven't as Asian Americans, as Korean Americans? And then are there places where we can speak into peace and reconciliation in our motherland that has been split for the last 70 years? Is there work that can be done to bring some sort of towards more healing in a divided country, right? With this unending war for the last 70 years, like, is there a place for a small, you know, organization like us to do some sort of an active part? And it seems so big, and seems so like ridiculously unreachable. But in the last 9 years, we've been able to do those things. It's like crazy that we were able to do some capacity of all of that. And I just felt like, wow, that must be from God, because that vision was so big, we could not have done it. If it was just me, I would have had like two layers, right? Like, let's focus on our family and let's maybe think about, you know, our church. But this expansive vision, I think God honored it. And we've taken steps of faith, and God has met us and beyond. And so that was kind of the work of, that's the work and the vision of reconciliation. And as we've been doing that work, I've been tapped to do the work of the denomination. And I think what's really interesting is all the nonprofit work of doing everything from the ground really has been helpful to do this peace and transformative peace work for the denomination, because we're a small denomination. We don't just do this one little sliver of like, well, this is my work. We do things collaboratively, and we are not a hierarchical, you know, structure as much as we don't like that. Sometimes it's easier because it's more compartmentalized, but we really do work and use all of the gifts of organizing, of, you know, really working with each other, hearing each other out, looking from different perspectives of spiritual formation, peace and justice, church, you know, from conference, from congregational level. And I love that all the little work that I've done in, you know, my husband and I were church planters before that, and then doing our nonprofit work, that those little pieces, nothing is wasted in God's eyes, right? And so those are the gifts that I've brought to our denominational work to oversee the peace and justice related work. And I see it more holistically, maybe because I'm a mom, I don't know. You know, I don't separate a lot of these things. I see it as an integral part of the whole. I think if we see that the heart of the gospel is the gospel of peace and reconciliation, then all the work of transformative peacemaking touches on everything that we do as a church, right? How we preach, what we preach, how we do work, what concerns us. And I think that expansiveness has been really challenging, And it's been really, really amazing. And now, you know, my focus will be on the racial ethnic engagement, seeing that we also need to look at like and address the peace work that goes outside of the church, right? Right now, you know, there's so much happening around the world, the pandemic, the war, you know, racism unfolding, all of these things. And sometimes what happens within our churches is that we focus outwardly, which is great, and we need to do that work. But at the same time, we have to address the internal work, right? Mm-hmm. We have to make sure that we, as we address racism, that our churches need to examine our structures and how whiteness plays out in our structures and our agencies. Mm-hmm. And so, and how do we empower our racial ethnic groups to engage, right? What are the needs that have not been shared for multiple reasons? Is it cultural issues? Is it linguistic issues? Is it theological issues? Who are the, you know, and a lot of the times our racial ethnic leaders are elders in our churches, which is rightly so. But who are the emerging leaders in our racial ethnic groups? And who's reaching out to them? And who's giving them the opportunity to do different, to lead, right, in different capacity? And who's giving them those opportunities and making the relational connections with them? And so that part I'm really excited about. And then to really connect with our agencies and see, like, what are they doing? Because they're doing good work. But sometimes they're doing it so internally, we can kind of see, wait a minute, that's also happening in different agencies. And so how can we resource one another and help each other towards a more vibrant and diverse, you know, denomination that is active inwardly as well as outwardly in the things that we say that we're about? That's a long answer.
Gospel.
The Gospel according to John. Then Mary took a pound of ointment of spikenard, very costly, and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the odor of the ointment. Then saith one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, which should betray him, why was not this ointment sold for 300 pence and given to the poor? This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the bag and bare what was put therein.
Extra, extra.
There's so much there that I want to dig back into, and I'm going to bring back around, but let's take a little break and do the centerpiece of this conversation, because remember, we talk about this being a podcast for people who attend church on Christmas and Easter.
Yes.
I don't know about the Korean Baptist church that you grew up in, but the Black Baptist church that I grew up in, we call them CME Christians, which means Christmas, Mother's Day, and Easter, which are,
Mother's Day.
You know. Yeah. You know, those are the three most important now. So tell me about a Christmas or Easter memory.
Goodness, I have so many. I think it's kind of funny, you know, Christmas, seeing your Korean deacon dressed up as white Santa Claus. I think it's pretty hilarious. but when I think about Easter, one of the most memorable moments is this youth pastor that we had, Pastor Wood, Reverend Wood. And he was a white man married to a Korean woman in this small little church in Alhambra, California. He was a very like mild-tempered, kind of quiet man. So, you know, but he had this presence and he really wanted to, and I don't remember everything he's done, but what I remember is he sang a song at Easter, My Tribute by Andy Crouch. Do you remember that song?
Oh, yeah.
And that,
yes, ma'am.
that moment, I mean, that song has stuck with me, Jason, for so long. Oh. And this man who is, you know, serving a little Korean church, singing this song and knowing a little bit about his background, to sing that song, was something that remains with me. And that's every time I hear that song, or every time I sing that song, I think about that moment when he sang that song during Easter. Hmm. Yeah, to God be the glory, right? We could both sing it probably. To wrap that, like what faith means, what it means, you know, you talked about, yeah, what does it mean to be a leader? What does it mean to give God all glory with all of our lives, right? And to live a life of thanksgiving in all that we do. He kind of wrapped it up, and that stays with me. Yeah. Like, that's the song I want to sing. Every Easter, you know, even though it's not like a super Easter song, but that's the memory.
Well, you know, in a way it could. Just got to put in the right part of the service, you know, so right. After the sermon.
But you know, Jason, what he reminds me is we influence people. Sometimes it's not about like a lot of things. It's a moment that changes you, right? It's leaders. Mm. It's not about the perfect theology. It's not about like perfect life or a long relationship. But he was there for a brief moment in this little immigrant church. And that song has stayed with me. So I just, those Easter, Mother's Day, Christmas folks, you know, we have a moment with them. We have a moment or a song with them that can be lasting, that can change them. Yeah.
Gospel.
The Gospel according to John. Then Jesus said, "Let her alone. Against the day of my burying hath she kept this. For the poor always ye have with you, but me ye have not always."
Extra, extra.
Let's bring it on to the tail end, because I have some things that I noticed that you brought up, and I want to bring those back around as well.
Mm.
But as you know, we structure these episodes on the scripture reading for the Sunday that we post these on. Sometimes post on Monday, but, you know, aspire to do it on Sunday. So the scripture reading for this week is from John 12, 1 through 8. And it is the story of, since we mentioned Andre Crouch, a great gospel singer, writer, / composer. You can reference a C.C. Winan song. Mm. You can say the woman with the alabaster box.
Yeah.
So in this version, it is identified as being Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus. And of course, she blesses Jesus with the ointment, puts on his feet, and wipes it with her hair. And I'm actually getting into the lyrics of the song. I'm confusing what the lyrics of the song. Maybe I should just sing the song.
Yes.
But then it says that Judas corrects her, and it says that, hey, he says, use his money, use it for the poor, which, you know, was a regular practice of Jesus and his disciples. But what I want to get into is that it identifies it as, you know, a Mary and Martha passage, and often they had conflict in how they followed Christ and the roles that they played. Martha was more of a servant, and Mary was more of a student / disciple. But when we break down what ministry literally means, it literally means servant or service. And then highlighting Judas's part, and not Judas just as the betrayer, but Judas as a disciple in good terms at that point, so one of the leaders in Christianity at that point. Can we talk about your work with women in leadership, and then the challenges to women in ministry, and then the example of mansplaining that you get in that story of Judas checking Mary and saying, hey, I see how you're trying to serve the Lord. I see how you're trying to minister here, but let me explain to you the proper way of what we do and how things are done here. And Christ correcting him.
You know, when I saw this, I'm like, oh, we could talk forever, especially you and me. I think we could talk about this passage for a long time.
We can, but I have to pay for extra minutes on the podcast, so you know.
Yeah, I see this juxtaposition, right? This story is told in all of the Gospels, and I love that.
Yes.
And I love that it's told in different ways, that it's told here. We see it happening right before Lent, during Lent. That's when we kind of read this passage, right? This mm-hmm. anticipation of Jesus going to his death. And this woman that knows Jesus, they both know Jesus, right? But in this woman who has been sitting at Jesus' feet, like literally coming and doing this sensual, generous, beautiful, inexplainable, lavish gesture of ceremony, right? And I love that here, instead of it being poured over his head, it's at his feet, right? I just love this passage where she knew, she actually heard, because if you know, Jesus talked a lot about his death.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously the disciples have also heard this, but have not understood it. And yeah. Here is this woman who has known Jesus for a long time too, heard Jesus and did something about it, right? And did something, something lavish, something that was wasteful. And I love that if our churches can imagine doing things in a different way than what we think we're supposed to be doing, our church could look different. If we could allow women to do things that don't make sense to men, our church can look different. I think it would be sensual in terms of sensing. Imagine the aroma. Imagine the touch of the hair, right? Imagine being in that room as that alabaster jar, as we would say in Cece's voice, right? Like, as that broke, right? The audacity, the wastefulness, the scent that was filling. I wonder what worship would look like, right? If we had more women involved in worship.
Mm-hmm.
If we could let women lead what it means to love Jesus, what it means to worship Jesus, what it means to mourn, what it means to prepare. Like, I just think that would look so different. I see, you know, Judas saying the right thing, right? But who is doing the right thing? You know, I think as Anabaptists, we think I'll talk a lot about doing, right? If we say, like, are you a Christian? The famous answer is, I don't know, ask my neighbor, right?
Mm.
So it's the... We can talk good theology, and theology is critical. But good theology doesn't always bring you to worship. Good theology doesn't always take you to Jesus. I think sound theology can stop just on an intellectual level. But notice in this passage, Mary doesn't say anything. And I see Mary doing the worship, doing her theology. And so with, you know, in our Women in Leadership for MCUSA, One of the things that we do is host a biannual conference called, you know, Woman Doing Theology. And I love that phrase because it's not woman talking theology. It's woman doing theology because women under our theology is often embodied. Not because we don't have it up here. The intellect, we can have good intellectual conversations, but unless it's embodied, it's our faith doesn't really spread, right? Doesn't actually make an impact in our rooms, in spaces where we are. And so I compare like Jesus, Judas's words with this scent, this aroma that's like filling the room, right? And I love that Jesus says, leave her alone. Just love that. Like, leave her alone. Like, we could meditate on that verse for all of Lent, right? Yeah, leave her alone. Let her be. Let her do the thing. Let her do the thing that is right. And I've been pondering that, and that again, that this passage, this picture is shown in all Gospels. This woman doing theology.
Like I said, you know, we both come from a shared Baptist background, and I don't know what the specifics were like in the Korean Baptist church when you grew up, but when I was younger, very much when I was young, women in leadership in the Black Baptist church was very much controversial. That changed a lot with like the Full Gospel Baptist Church in the 90s, and that even other churches that were of various Baptist conferences, it became more of a normal thing to have women speak in general in a church, then later to become elders and ministers. But still in groups like the Southern Baptist Church, you know, Beth Moritz left them, you know, that is, it is a no-go. And we have listeners who are going to be from different traditions, but most Christian denominations still struggle with or do not allow women in official leadership. But here's the thing. The work is being done by women.
Yep.
The titles are not had by women.
That's right.
And the work, as you said, is theology being done. You know, I've been in meetings, you know, and attended Catholic services, so Catholicism probably will not have women priests in our lifetime. But the women are doing the work there. And I'm not just talking about the nuns. I'm talking about people in committees. I'm talking about someone's grandmother who's running certain sections of the church. The priest may be in leadership, but that is doing certain things on Sundays. Throughout the week, it is being done by women in the congregation. Whatever your most fundamentalist Protestant denomination may be, women are doing the work in that congregation. So we really need to rethink, what do we really mean by leadership? Because if we mean leading in work, it has always been done by women. And we can take it back to the scripture, because Jesus was financially supported by a group of, I think it was like 3 to 5 women. So what is with this hesitation? And where do you see it in our lifetime going to officially recognize women as the leaders in much of Christianity?
Yeah, that's a huge question. I can tell you a story about my mother-in-law, who is 80 years old. She served at a Korean church for over 30 years at this one mega church in Korea. Mega churches
are
no joke. Yeah, in Korea, like if you have 1,000, that's like not, that's considered a small church. So mega church means like over 15,000 people. But she was there from almost the very beginning of this church. After 30 years, and after her husband died, my father-in-law, she felt like now she gets to do what she really wants to do and what she felt called to do. And so she wanted to go and be a missionary. And loving your enemies, she wanted to go to Japan. And in Japan, for multiple reasons. But anyway, so she felt called to go. And she told her pastor, who she's known for over 30 years, right? She felt compelled to go and serve and do ministry there for, since she's now over 60. But one of the stipulation was that for her to do ministry actively there, she would have to be ordained. Mm-hmm. And talking about serving, this woman has served in every capacity in that church for over 30 years, very involved. And yet her pastor said, if you won't be ordained in my church because that's not what we do. Women should not be ordained. And if you do decide to be ordained elsewhere, we will not support you, and we will stop other people from supporting you. And so she was deeply hurt, right? Because there's this call, and yet she was also threatened.
Wow.
She decided to go, and she decided to be ordained by another an organization that ordains women. She received no support. She didn't get any support from friends of the incredible network that she had there, because they were afraid that if the pastor, lead pastor, finds out, that they would also be shunned. And so that's patriarchy at its finest.
Yes.
And so for 17 years, she struggled financially. And yet she continued to minister, and she's just returned to Korea and still struggling still, because she doesn't have a livelihood in Korea. She doesn't have any pension. She doesn't have anything saved in a very patriarchal system and in a patriarchal church, right? And so my husband is actually in Korea right now trying to help her find low-income housing and all of these things. So that's patriarchy for you. That is very costly. In real life. And we see this, how we understand, you know, I also struggled because I wasn't sure if I should be a pastor. You know, I never saw someone like me in ministry. If they were, this is what we get. I don't know in your church, but when I was growing up in an immigrant church, and if you are very you have leadership and you are very faithful, they'll come to you. These older folks will say, oh my gosh, Sue, you're such a strong Christian, and I see so much leadership in you. You make such a great pastor's wife.
Yeah.
Like, they can't, and I've heard that so many times, no one has told me, Sue, you would make a wonderful pastor, because that frame wasn't there, because of patriarchy, right? And because of our theology that's so embedded in patriarchy, right? In a Korean, system, we have patriarchy and we have Confucianism. That goes nicely in terms of women subordinating, right? And so there are so many layers to unpack there. But I also always go back to the story of Easter, right? And how Jesus entrusts the gospel of the resurrection, the story of the resurrection, to Mary. And I said, and the disciples didn't believe her. And so, if that was a challenge for Mary, it's a challenge for me as well. And it's sad, right? That we still are not trusted, that we are still not believed. And yet, I think this is an integral, this is a point in history where women do have a lot of agency. Someone looking like me, an Asian American woman, having education, having the language, the colonial language, but I have access to a language that is international. I have education, I have top education. Although there are so many systems of patriarchy at play, there is this sliver, there is this opportunity that women have not had before. And so we're asking the questions of why, of women in leadership, women in ministry, women as pastors. And so I don't know how much I will see in my lifetime of how patriarchy will be dismantled, but at such a time, with what we know, and such a time in history, I feel like we can start addressing those questions. And we are. With Women in Leadership, we're asking, we're putting together a survey of women, and their women in ministry, and the ways that they have been bullied. Different ways that not only, you know, we talk about pastoral misconduct, and but vice versa, women in ministry have been bullied, and how do we address that? As a church, we're also talking about prevention and accountability, and we're updating our policies about sexual misconduct and how that's dealt with. These are different ways that we are trying to dismantle and address patriarchy in the church, right? So how do we uplift the stories of women in the church, and how do we make sure that there's accountability and a prevention so that a woman in ministry can thrive? And so in that way, I think our Mennonite church has ways to go, but there are things that are being done to address those harm and to address patriarchy in a real systematic way. And we're talking a lot about power these days, and how patriarchy and sexualized violence, and how power is at play. And so the core thing is really talk about power.
Ever since Eve bit into an apple in the Garden of Eden, God has been rough on women. Or, more precisely, the men who claim to speak on behalf of God have routinely disparaged women or discriminated against them. The New York Times.
I have two small questions, be very short. I didn't prep you for these, but they're not trick questions, okay? You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Number one, who is Jesus?
That's a short question.
That's a short question. Hey.
Jesus Jesus is God incarnate, who has shown us how we are to live in this world.
This is the Ministry 101 exam. All right. If that is the case, what then is the gospel?
Yeah, the gospel is to live out and follow what Jesus had done, to prioritize what Jesus said who he is about, you know, Luke 4, to set the captives free. If our gospel is not liberative, then I really don't know. And if it's not, I shared already, if the gospel is a gospel of release so that we can freely love God, release to love ourselves, to love each other, to love God's creation, to be in harmony with that, and to make sure that that's not just you, but it's for all. I think that's the gospel.
You know, I can share this with you, since we both were raised Baptist. Secretly, the inside of me is definitely always Baptist. I'll never be culturally be non-Baptist. So when someone is making a point, especially when you are sharing the truth, those points you hit on the inside of me, I'm calm here, but the inside of me is having a very much a Baptist, Black Baptist, 1980s, I just listened to Andre Crouch, and I'm going to listen to James Cleveland as I drive home reactions, and I'm calm, but the inside of me is like, amen. That's right. The inside of me is jumping up and is about to run down the pew because the gospel is being shared. And you had so many points. And when you brought it back to Luke 4, I'm like, that's right. That is right.
That's where I go back to. You know, if I lose sight of what it means to be, because, you know, doing church work, doing denominational work, there's so many different things that get in the way. And I just have to refocus. Like, what are we focusing on? Like, when we go to get your eyes checked, you have to stay, you know, focus on that one picture, right? And for me, that little vision of the house or whatever that we're supposed to be focusing on, even though things get blurry, is to keep my course, keep the course, and remember what we're about. And it is to help people be set free and to recognize who Jesus centers in that little picture, right? It's always about the marginalized and the poor. And the unseen, right? And to center on that, because that's what Jesus did. He didn't hate the rich, but his focus was always on the most marginalized people. And so we have to not lose sight as a church to focus on what Jesus focused on.
So as wonderful as that New York Times article that we started out with was, when I scroll back up to the top of the article, I noticed that it was written by Nicholas Kristof. And if you aren't familiar with the name of that writer, just know Nicholas is a boy's name. And just like me, Jason, and this podcast, it is a man that is mansplaining to other men and even women listeners or readers how we should take women's voices seriously. Just like in the Gospel of John 12:1-8, where Jesus has to tell his disciples to back down to accept a woman's self-directed ministry as valid. That same woman who Jesus later told to tell the remaining disciples of his resurrection. What if the day came when we didn't need male defenders to get people to take women as seriously as God does? What if we recognize one day that not only do women hear the voice and call of God, but God hears their voices, and so should we.